The tape that you are about to hear has been declassified by disability and disadvantage analysts at CFMU Radio. This taped record of conversation had never been heard before being released to you, the CFMU listener. This tape has been condensed and edited from live, personal, or telephone conversation. You will hear privileged discussions, damning indictments, and stark revelations. Once known collectively only to the agents intercepting them, these files have been tagged with the distinct identifier, disrespect. Disrespect welcomes David Sparling, the Chair of Agri-Food Innovation at the Richard Ivey School of Business. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Jeff. Okay. Nice to be here.
Okay.
It's 2008, really. There's sort of been a number of waves of commodity prices. And 2008, commodity prices really spiked.
Okay.
And they came, couldn't have come at a worse time. We're going into a global recession.
Right.
Everybody was worried about their job. And certainly retailers didn't feel that they were in too much of a position to raise prices to consumers just when they're getting hit with a major recession. So there was a lot of price resistance at the retail level. But commodity prices rose, energy prices rose, and so food processors and farmers, you know, were essentially selling into retailers without really much in the way of price increases.
Okay.
And they were squeezed very tight.
Mm-hmm.
Then things eased off in 2009, and then they started back up in sort of 2010. And since then, we sort of had a couple of waves. And really, until pretty much the last year, we weren't seeing much in the way of overall increases in food prices.
Okay.
Partly that was the squeeze, and the other thing that was happening was because the Canadian dollar was higher, imported food was cheaper. So that was also...
Oh, that was masked, right.
So it masked it. We've been now at a pretty even dollar for a few years, and so that part of the masking is pretty much gone. Energy prices keep going up, which increases the price of producing food, processing food, shipping food, all of those things. And so we are now finally, and the economy's okay, but not certainly anything but great.
Mm-hmm.
And I think food companies are just in a position that they really said we can't operate at such thin margins any longer, and they started to increase food prices. And the retailers are passing those along.
Okay. But you say commodity prices are still going up, right?
Yeah. You know, they dipped for a while, and then they seem to be going back up again. And, you know, how far now, today, they're supposedly dipping again. So...
Really?
Certainly the long... the long-term projections are for food prices to continue increasing, probably a few percent a year, so ahead of the normal inflation rate.
Okay. So the cost of food as a proportion of anybody's budget is going to rise.
And yes, because our salaries are not going up. Most people's salaries are, staying pretty level.
You notice that too, eh?
Pardon?
You notice that too.
Yeah. Well, it's a tough economic environment, and it's hard for people to get salary increases in this kind of environment, and it's hard for people to find employment.
Unfortunately, it seems energy prices and food prices are increasingly directly linked. As crops for instance, ethanol become more valuable, they claim more land. The land for producing other foods goes down, the crops from those land become more desirable and more scarce. As the price goes up, the price for things like meat, which is a sort of a byproduct or an end product of growing oil seeds and grains, goes up still further because, of course, there's a lot of grain required to produce a cow or a pig.
Yeah, and there are actually a couple of things going on with the meat price increase. First of all, we got hit with BSE, which closed a lot of markets. Both our hog and our beef business really built up quite a bit through the 90s to service the U.S. market.
Okay.
And that was because we had a free trade agreement, which allowed us to sell pretty easily into the States, and then we had an extremely attractive dollar.
All right.
So both of those industries got pretty big, but they were shipping, 40% or so of what they produce into the U.S.
Okay.
In 2003, when the BSE hit, that got backed off for a bit. But what's happened more recently has been the rise in the dollar. That made it really hard for Canadian meat producers to compete in the U.S. And
yeah.
So actually, more of the meat stayed in Canada. That created a glut of meat. And so that part of the reason meat prices have been pretty good over the last few years has been because we really had too much production for the market. We've now seen both pork and beef production back off.
Really? What's replacing it?
Well, when prices stay low for a long time, people just get out of those businesses. They just exit, and then on the other side, if they happen to have cropland, they could sell the crops and not put the feed into animals, which really weren't making them any money.
Okay.
So they're much better off to sell profitable crops than unprofitable animals.
All right. So the price of animals goes up.
So the price of animals is now starting to become a little more acceptable to producers.
Okay.
So meat prices are starting to go up at the farm, which means meat prices go up at processing and at retail. So there's a number of things that are happening all at the same time that are really passing pretty much overdue price increases on to consumers.
Wow.
Yeah.
And the pressure's continuing, right?
And
with ethanol, the pressure's continuing.
And that one is, it's not just the fact that the land is used, it's also the fact that corn is now a substitute for oil in some ways because of the ethanol. And and so when that happens, the two start to move in tandem. So corn prices will, if oil prices really spike, then corn prices will start to drift up because they can say, oh, well, I can sell that into the ethanol market, and it will be more competitive. So,
and in Canada, apparently the western provinces are using grain for ethanol.
Well, they're using, there's canola for biodiesel and things like that. So there are a number of, we can use soybean into biodiesel, but ethanol is really, in Canada, ethanol is the main thing. And yes, and here we do it from corn typically, but you can also do it from wheat and so on.
There's no progress being made with the use of cast-off materials from crop.
Well, that's an interesting area. There is progress, but it's not moving as quickly as people would like, which is essentially what you call cellulosic. So you use the other parts of the plant other than the edible parts. So you can use the stalk or the leaves and chop them up and then use that to produce ethanol. That is progressing, and there's more coming out of that, but it's still not really, I don't think the science is perfected, and I don't think the economics are great yet.
Okay.
It will come.
So where does that leave the consumer? It leaves them with a diminishing income after paying for their food.
Yes.
Does it leave them a choice to?
We've gone for years with a relatively inexpensive food in Canada, and it's a very small part of our. It's typically 9 or 10%, up to I think maybe up to 12% of our budget goes into food. That's probably going to drift up.
Mm-hmm.
Which is tough, and for quite a few years now, I think the Canadian Federation of Agriculture keeps track of the what they call Food Freedom Day, when Canadians on average have earned enough to pay for their food for the entire year, and that's been February 12th for quite a few years. I think 5 years ago it was late February, and then it went down to the 12th of February, and I think it was there for at least 4 years.
who establishes that?
I think it's the Canadian Federation of Agriculture.
Okay. All right. But we're expecting this year it's later, or?
Well, I think we will see when it comes to next year. I think you won't see Food Freedom Day on February 12th. My guess would probably be going to be more like the 20th or so.
Okay.
So we're going to see higher food costs overall,
and
with higher energy costs, it's almost even with all the other things out. Just the cost of energy in the whole food system warrants the fact that we're definitely going to expect a higher food prices.
That bespeaks a cascade of other changes, because I recall in the recession, it was remarked that people went off brand. They went to house brands and stuff like that to cut their costs. Well, they've done that now.
Yep.
So they're going to have to make more major changes if they want to level out their or reduce the increase in their food costs, aren't they?
Yes, they are. You know, that means, you know, there are a bunch of things you can do. If you happen to be fortunate enough to have a garden, that can be relatively productive, at least in certain times of year. And it looks like this year might be longer than normal.
Okay.
You know, making sure that you buy things on special, working a little harder at preparing your menus so they're still healthy, because you definitely want to get your, the fruits and vegetables and grains into the diet. So you don't want to change that. So you just have to make sure you shop a little more carefully, prepare your weekly grocery list pretty carefully, and look for sale items.
Yeah. Is it going to change the balance of food in people's diets? Are we going to eat less meat? Are we going to eat different cuts of meat or more fish? Or I would imagine the fish question depends on where you live.
Fish question depends on where you live, and there's certainly lots of recommendations that you should be eating fish at least once a week for the omega-3 side of things.
Yeah.
Certainly people can economize by reducing some of their meat consumption or reducing some of the more expensive treats and things like that. But, there's only so much, and you want a really well-balanced diet, so you don't want to be taking out anything too serious. You know, and longer term, and this is quite a bit longer term, but I think we're seeing a lot more research into the relationship between food and health.
All right.
And with genomics and traditional breeding as well as biotechnology, I think we'll see, healthier attributes. For example, you can get omega-3 pork products from a producer in Ontario, Willowgrove Farms, who actually make pork that has high omega-3s, which is what you want to get out of eating salmon, for example.
Yeah.
So that's a sort of really good
thing. These are flax-fed hogs?
I'm not sure what he feeds them.
Okay. All right. So you're thinking in the short term, whatever major changes the public can stomach, and we can't see any obvious ones any further, and in the long term, an improvement in the quality of food to facilitate changes because of the rising price.
Yes, I think there's already quite a bit of work going on in food companies. They recognize that, some of the processed foods are certainly not the healthiest, and that there's, as companies, there are things that they can do to actually make the food still taste as good, but be healthier for people.
Yeah. I wonder what this means for people on low or fixed incomes, given even that the Canada Pension, with its index to inflation, is essentially a fixed income. It may not be a declining income, but with food prices rising more than inflation, it effectively becomes a declining income, doesn't it?
Because it does. And it means that the people may have to readjust other parts of their life to adapt to that. And possibly look at other ways of producing food or buying food collectively so that they keep the same quality but cut their costs.
It's funny. You bring that question home to me in two ways. Last night, I was approached by a relative who said, "Do you want a plot of land in our community garden?" And I said, I am having a lot of trouble with my income right now. I have to straighten out that trouble before I can have time to use the plot in your community garden. But now, Now that I look at it, I've got it backwards. I have to use your community garden until I can straighten out the income problem.
Well, the community garden is a pretty inexpensive way to get great food that's really good for you, tastes good, and is unbelievably fresh because you go and pick it and bring it home for dinner. So, and it's also the other thing about it is just getting outside and you know, working with a garden is very therapeutic. You know, it's got all kinds of other health benefits beyond simply what you eat. So, yeah. you could be right on that note.
Yeah. Now, the major food producers cope with our narrow growing season by freezing, canning, and even drying. These are not options that everybody with a community garden can take advantage. How do people with community gardens take advantage of the mass yield and then the famine that follows, so to speak?
Yeah, the old traditional ways of canning, you know, in our case we use glass jars, but of canning, if you have access to a freezer or freezing, some vegetables will store, especially some of the root vegetables will store very well just that in a cool room, if you can find someplace cool to store them.
Okay.
Without really having to go into freezers or so on. I do want to raise one point that you make me think of when you talk about freezing. One of the things that people can do is look for specials on, if they have to have a freezer or access to it, look for specials on frozen food, fruits and vegetables, because those are picked fresh and then frozen almost immediately.
Okay.
And so they can be allowed to ripen more, and then they are frozen really fresh. And they tend to be often less expensive, with less waste than some of the fresh fruits. And so I think it's an area that we've sort of moved away from frozen food, but especially if you're looking for, stuff that's very seasonal, but you'd like to get it from a local source.
Okay.
I think it's a really good alternative.
Well, thank you. I invested when I moved into my apartment that I have now. There are a number of other things that need remediation there, but I invested in a stand-up freezer, and I've only used it periodically, so it's time probably to get the thing running for good over the summer and into the fall.
Especially if you start to garden, because you can store most things that come out of a garden. Not lettuce, of course, and things like that, and tomatoes, but you can store, everything, peas, beans, carrots, all of those sorts of things you can harvest and then cut up and store. If you do squash, you can cut those up and store them, too. I think you have to blanch them first. But
okay.
That will be a good asset if you do get into that community gardening initiative.
Yeah. Well, and for the uninitiated, I've just become acquainted with what blanching means. Blanching means you bring the plant to a boil for a number of minutes, and then you submerge it in chilled water, and then you freeze it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what blanching does for it, but it's an essential ingredient in a lot of cooking.
Well, it just helps it retain its, the quality and the flavor.
Really?
Yep.
Okay. Well, the other thing you've brought home to me, and I didn't want to announce before the interview, is that I'm going into a major regional hospital in another city tomorrow for a cardiac stent. And diet change is very much on my mind. And there was a recent study that pointed out that red meat, and particularly processed red meat, guarantees you a shorter lifespan, and that maybe the changes that the economy is calling for are changes that I'm being called to make in other ways too. And I'm not quite sure of what's going to result, but I know that when I get out of the hospital on perhaps Sunday or Saturday, I want to be ready to step into a different diet. I'm going into the hospital with a book on a different diet. I'm going to see if that's the one.
Well, what you probably want to be doing is talking to the hospital dietitians, because they will be able to give you recommend a really good diet for essentially for your particular condition, because this is not something new to them, and I would certainly access their expertise while you're there.
Certainly for the listener, I can point out that you can avoid this situation or certainly put it off till later in life if you will pay attention to your diet now, and it may pay you to pay attention to your diet now.
And exercise on top of that.
Well, yeah, for sure.
Both of those are critical.
Yeah. I don't know that you can probably divide people on low incomes into two categories, those who walk everywhere and those who just sit around.
Mm-hmm.
And I would imagine there's a large number of them who walk everywhere that exercises, while organized exercise is probably beyond their budgets, exercise itself is, you know, the non-aerobic, repetitive, continuous walking kind that contributes, as far as I know, to cardiovascular health is no stranger to people on low incomes.
Well, that's right. And walking has been shown to be really one of the best things that you can do.
Really?
So you don't need to go into really hard, vigorous exercise to get most of the health benefits. We thought that for quite a few years, but more recently people said, you know, if you go out and you walk for 30 or 40 minutes every day, you can have exactly the same kind of life expectancy and overall health impact as a much more vigorous exercise, and anybody can afford to walk, and everybody should.
So with these changes happening to the price of food and the cost of food, which is driving up the price, and the cost of energy, which is driving up the cost of food and the price, rather than radical adaptation, and I suppose for some people the use of house brands is a radical change if you've been buying at high-end grocery stores and picking what you buy by what you like rather than by the cost or the nutritional content, then it seems there's a panoply, there's an array of changes that can be made to cope with these rising food costs.
Absolutely. And you know, when we talk about, you know, changing brands or whatever, one of the things that people should be starting to do regularly is reading the labels, so you know exactly, you know, what
yeah,
you
that's
are getting
true.
In these.
Yeah.
When you start to compare products, and if you see, you know, one has higher levels of salt or another one has higher levels of vitamin and calcium, you know, you can make informed decisions that are, you know, good from an economic perspective, but also leave you at least in as good a place or better from a health perspective.
I've noticed in some of the items that are not technically food, things like energy drinks, that little box of nutrients that appears as ingredients on a can of tomatoes is not there. And I wonder, is it not required for everything that goes into our bodies? Are there categories of food for which it's not required?
I'm not sure. I don't buy energy drinks, and I think if you want to talk about places to save money, there's a fantastic opportunity.
Absolutely.
And because really, I don't think you get any health benefits out of them, and certainly there are way better ways to consume much better drinks to consume that won't cost you any more, probably cost you less, and be way better for you.
Listening people.
Like milk.
Listening people. Okay. Yeah. And maybe there's another thing that impinges on this. Maybe with the Harper government pursuing Pacific trade ties, maybe the national protection for dairy and poultry is about to be stepped down, wrung out.
Not likely.
You think
not likely in the short term.
Okay.
I think it may come up in the discussions, and there may be movements to open things up, and really a gradual reduction of tariffs would be one of the strategies that they could take, and that would start to put more downward pressure on supply-managed products. But I wouldn't think there would be a massive change in a really quick period of time. It would be too devastating to the industry.
It sounds like you think our trading partners, particularly the United States, Australia, and New Zealand, are willing to accept baby steps in this regard.
Well, and they may not be. But I think the political appetite for a major, major change in a really short period of time, I'd be very surprised to see that. So.
Yeah,
I do think there's an appetite for making change and for moving, and we certainly, you know, our government definitely wants to be in those trading zones. So
right.
We'll see.
All right. So that's a hope. as opposed to a tool at our disposal.
Yeah, the farming community wouldn't say that was a hope. They're quite concerned about it.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, they see themselves competing with American farmers or even,
that's right,
even Pacific Rim farmers, don't
yep.
they? And that would drive prices below cost, probably.
Mm-hmm.
I see. Well, we can expect a lot of discussion about it then in the newspapers and on the air.
Well, it's already started. So
yeah.
And that may be one of the ways that the government is float the idea to see what happens, what the reaction is. But
for people who are seriously interested in this issue about food, where would you go for more information about the dairy and poultry changes that are being booted around?
I know the Globe has run a couple of articles, and you can read that online in the last few days. And I don't think there is, there may be other papers across the country that are doing, but I don't think there's really too much discussion about that at this particular time.
No,
I think it's just
which
sort of
is why
around. It kicks around as part of the trade negotiations, and it gets brought up every once in a while, but. There doesn't seem to be, I don't think there's a public discourse going on should we be getting rid of this and how would that happen?
Especially after the wheat board.
Yeah.
Which hasn't settled down yet, yeah.
Well, yeah, and a lot of farmers, some farmers are quite upset and a lot of farmers are quite happy with that one being gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was quite a division. So you see costs, and both energy costs and food costs as volatile. We've had ups and downs recently, but the answer from the wholesalers is to keep pushing the prices up because they had to keep them flat for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And so the consequence for consumers is continually rising prices into a future which we can't clearly foresee now, but in which deregulation plays a part, but as far as we can see, not a large part.
No, and that, this is partly because of what's happening in Asia. Essentially, global demand for food, because of China and India, and because consumers are getting richer, global demand for food is just going to keep increasing.
All right.
And part of it's going into energy, but the main drivers for food costs right now are energy costs and more demand from developing countries.
And how does that impact an issue like deregulation?
It puts additional pressure to, to be a trading nation.
Okay.
And so that tends to lead to, more pressure for deregulation.
Okay. But not enough to produce a public dialogue as you see it, which is different in other areas of international trade.
Not yet.
Okay.
It may be enough in the future. Right now, I don't think so. Or it certainly hasn't at this particular point anyways.
Yeah, what with the euro crisis and the U.S.
Yep.
economy and whatnot,
we have a whole lot of stuff to worry about right now. The world has a lot of stuff to worry about now.
Well, that's an interesting conversation, wide-ranging conversation this time on a concerning phenomenon. What was it that you would like to say to sum up?
Oh, boy, I don't know. We seem to have covered a lot of ground. I mean, I just think that...
The future of food prices.
The future
increases.
Is going to be, I think, especially for commodities, the future is definitely going to be sort of prices trending higher and more volatility. That volatility doesn't tend to show up so much at retail level, but the trend to higher prices will continue. And so, to me, it's all about really being careful with your diet and careful with your budget all at the same time.
I see. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Jeff.
Okay. We didn't introduce you.
No, we didn't.
So I should run by your qualifications again and give you a proper introduction and get you to thank me, and then we can be done.
Okay. And the title I finally got shortened is just the Chair of Agri-Food Innovation at the Richard Ivey School of Business.
Okay. Etta James, again. The sky is crying.
The sky is crying. Look at the tears roll down the street. Look at the tears roll down. wonder where can he be. I saw my baby one morning. He was walking down the street. Till my poor heart would skip a beat. Now listen, I got a bad, bad feeling. My baby don't want me no more. I got a bad, bad, bad feeling. Tears rolling out my door.
The tape that you are about to hear has been declassified by Disability and Disadvantage Analysts at CFMU Radio. This taped record of conversation had never been heard before being released to you, the CFMU listener. This tape has been condensed and edited from live, personal, or telephone conversation. You will hear privileged discussions, damning indictments, and stark revelations. Once known collectively only to the agents intercepting them, these files have been tagged with the distinct identifier, disrespect. Disrespect welcomes Professor Sid Frankel, a professor in the Faculty of Social Work, yes?
Yes.
And campaign chair for?
Member of the Steering Committee of Campaign 2000.
Okay. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
We My interest in your comment came out of the letter that you wrote that was published in the Hamilton Spectator. Did you directly write the Spectator, or was it the Star?
No, I wrote the Globe and Mail.
Oh, that's where I encountered it.
Right.
Pardon to the Globe and Mail.
In the Globe.
Yeah, okay. Pardon to the Globe for that. And you mentioned the nature of poverty as having less to do with material deprivation, especially in the West, than it has to do with a reduction in participation and choice and voice. And I was very interested in that. How do we measure poverty? Is it consistent with that observation in the Western world?
Well, there's no consensus about this, first of all. No consensus among policymakers, no consensus among researchers. And in Canada, we don't have an official poverty line, which I think is quite unfortunate because there's no way to hold any government accountable for a poverty reduction plan. But to look at the various ways Stats Canada measures poverty in Canada, well, they have a measure of material deprivation, which is called the market basket measure and was agreed to by the federal and provincial ministers of social services.
Okay.
And what they have is a market basket of goods and services designed to maintain health.
Right.
And they price that market basket in local markets throughout the country. They're quite good at that. And that is one poverty line. And if you look at that poverty line only, the case I would make is that it only accounts for some of the effects of poverty.
All right.
There's another measure Statistics Canada collects called the low-income measure.
Right.
And that's the income level at 50% of the median income.
Okay.
So it's a measure much more sensitive to inequality, and it accounts not only for material deprivation, because people at those levels of income will have trouble buying what they need to, but it also accounts for the fact that they won't have the resources to participate socially, to send their kids on field trips, to participate going to hockey games with their neighbors, and also the psychological and social effect. People at the low end of the income ladder experience a lot of discrimination, a lot of stigmatization. They're blamed for their poverty, and they're citizens of the culture, and they tend to self-stigmatize.
And this isn't measured at all in either of these two previous measures.
Well, I would say the one that comes closest to measuring those three effects is the low-income measure.
All right. How does it do that?
Well, so it's really a measure that takes into account inequality.
Okay.
So it's looking, it's based on the median income, the income that divides the population or a particular family type in half. And then it takes the income level at one half of that median income.
All right.
So it's really looking at those at the low end, taking into account where everyone else is, taking into account the base that describes everyone else.
All right. So tell us again, I mean, I'm not sure how many people who are good at math are listening to us, but tell us again what the median is.
Just the income level that divides the population in half.
Okay, and how's it established?
Well, it's established by Statistics Canada through a survey of incomes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually going to be problematic to establish it accurately since the long form of the census is gone, because they used to use the census to weight that survey. But there's a survey of incomes called the Survey of Labor and Income Dynamics, and they look at the distribution of income for various family types.
All right.
And they find the middlemost income for each family type. That's the median income.
So what does the middlemost income mean? I mean, middlemost.
Just that half the population would be above it and half the population would be at or below it.
Very good. Okay. All right.
Okay. And then it takes the income level that's 50% of that middlemost income
right.
in defining poverty.
Okay. All right. Your definition of poverty had more to do with the three properties that you mentioned earlier, the other than material deprivation.
Yeah, it's not just material deprivation. It is material deprivation. People living in poverty by that measure don't have the resources to purchase the food, shelter, clothing, and transportation and so on that they need. But it's much more than that. It's also the fact that they can't participate and their children can't participate in their communities, in society, in all of the normal ways. And furthermore, and there's very clear evidence of the negative health and psychological effects, it's being in a stigmatized group.
Okay.
It's discrimination from others on the basis of what your income is, you know, based on where you live and how you look, and it's self-stigmatization.
All right.
Because people, poor people end up very often blaming themselves.
Oh.
And my case is that the low-income measure, for example, is much more correlated with early mortality, morbidity for a whole range of physical and mental health diseases, because it takes into account not only material deprivation, but these other two factors.
And the other two, again, are discrimination?
And the inability to participate.
And the inability to participate. Hamilton did, the Hamilton Spectator, I have to give them credit, did a study on this recently called Code Red, and they were shocked to find that the variation in lifespan between the highest income areas of Hamilton and the lowest
right.
income areas of Hamilton was almost 20 years.
Right, and these findings occur everywhere.
Yeah.
So there are studies in the UK, in the US, in Canada, in the developing world, and they've been shown to persist over time. So on average, where you live is a marker of your socioeconomic status, and if you live in a neighborhood in which poverty is predominant, unfortunately, you have a better than average chance of dying early.
And this is based on, I mean, I don't dispute that result. I've seen the statistics and I've seen the mm-hmm. life. I've seen the lives too. But what is this based on? It's based on a whole host of things, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
The ability to purchase a nutritious diet, but beyond
this has
that.
Been well studied, starting with the famous Whitehall studies.
Right.
The studies of British civil servants who weren't poor.
Right.
But this showed that there is an effect from material deprivation, but it's the smallest effect.
Right.
The greatest effects of poverty are from stress.
I believe that.
Excuse me?
I believe that.
Yeah. So
it came from an interview
in neighborhoods with a lot of risks.
Yeah.
And the psychological stress of feeling like there's no way out and like you're a loser, the kind of social comparison. So there are very measurable stress effects, you know, which are really quite important. Conservatives often point to lifestyle issues.
Mm-hmm.
The poor are more likely to smoke and engage in a whole range of behaviors that are associated with poor health. This is a very small effect, and the evidence is very much that this is a result of poverty, not a cause of poverty.
In other words, a response to the stress, for instance.
Yeah, it's a poor but available way of coping, you know, with this overwhelming stress.
Yeah. Well, I just came from an interview with my worker direct to the studio here today. I was here about 5:30, but the day concluded with an interview with my worker, and it was brought home to me again how stress affects people on fixed incomes.
Yes, and of course, our income maintenance systems often increase that stress.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So, for example, in the Ontario Child Health Study, poor children whose families receive funding from income maintenance are worse off psychologically and in terms of health than children at equal income whose parents are low-wage workers. So,
I see.
And that has to do, I'm sure, with the kind of additional stress that the system induces in the way it monitors and sets rules and so on and so forth.
Yeah. And as we know, the kids pick this up from the parents, too. They're very sensitive to this. Yeah.
Well, one of the major, this has been studied, so it has been shown that poor parents who are highly stressed do not parent as well.
All right.
And that stress is transmitted into developmental problems for the kids. Now, not across the board, and I certainly don't want to be understood as labeling the poor as
poor
bad
parents. Yeah.
But the origin really has to do with the stress on the parent relating to having to cope with low income and often relating to having to live in a place with a lot of risks.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, if you don't have the money to live in an upmarket neighborhood, then you're going to be dealing with people who engage in these avoidance and palliative behaviors
right.
that you've indicated that not only do they smoke, not only do they drink, but they probably do drugs. They're probably more violent because they are anxious for the things that they need.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the non-poor, those who are well off, they don't want prostitution in their neighborhood.
Right.
They make sure that the areas of prostitution are where the poor live in the inner city.
That's true.
They don't want drug dealing in their neighborhoods, even though their children and they may use drugs.
Yeah.
But they make sure their neighborhoods, on average, are well policed, and they add stress and risk to inner city neighborhoods.
Interesting. Okay. Where does that lead us in terms of how we deal with these effects, these very destructive effects of poverty? And, you know, you could argue almost that we are, by social policy, we're shortening the lives of these people.
Well, I think that's true. I think there's irrefutable evidence that a good piece of disease morbidity and premature mortality has to do with poverty, and governments are very worried about sustainability of the healthcare system, which usually means cost containment in the healthcare system. Really, the kind of cost containment that would pay off in the long run is effective poverty reduction. And for example, I think groups in Hamilton have come to appreciate that.
Oh, really? Such as?
And you do have a local council in Hamilton.
Okay.
Which it would probably be very worthwhile to talk to. The correct name is Hamilton Roundtable for Poverty Reduction.
I'm aware of them, yes.
Okay.
It was a group set up by City Hall, which leads some people to suspect that the answers that they're getting are only the answers that they want to permit themselves to hear. Nevertheless, they've been well praised, and they're now in the hands of real social activists, so it may be a group that's evolving.
Yes, and they've, for lack of a better metaphor, they've brought strange bedfellows together.
Okay.
They've been able to get business, government, labor, and poor people in the same room.
Very good. Okay.
And I think that is extremely important.
University of Manitoba sociology professor Sid Frankel talks about the other than material deprivation experienced in poverty. Do you see any end to the discrimination without addressing these issues of poverty and so forth successfully? I mean, it sounds like a rising tide lifts all boats situation. If you don't get rid of one of the determinants, then you have a hard time getting rid of the others.
Right. Well, the kind of stigmatization that poor people experience does have very real effects, and it's still one of the more stigmatized statuses in a society in which acquisition is very important. And, I think there's a whole bunch that needs to be done. I think part of it has to do with education.
Yeah.
I think kids in school should learn that blaming the poor for their poverty mm-hmm. among other things, just isn't accurate.
Mm-hmm.
I think many people like me who live privileged lives,
right?
Even people who advocate for the poor are sometimes uncomfortable with the poor and uncomfortable in the inner city.
That's true.
And, you know, I think we have to learn about the strengths of those neighborhoods and get to know people as people. And I think, you know, we're at a point where in Canada where we don't have the kinds of legal aid systems that were put into place in the 60s and 70s.
That's very evident.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the poor really can't often obtain justice, but as importantly, no one's taking a look at the poor as a group and the discrimination that they experience.
Yeah.
So I think there is a lot to be done there, and I think the media has a lot to do with it.
Oh, you think that blaming the poor is a media phenomenon among others?
Well, I sure think it occurs.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I remember, who's Lloyd Robertson, the newscaster for? CTV, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Retired recently.
Yeah, but it was CTV, wasn't it?
Right.
He did a newscast on disability fraud, which mm-hmm. I just stumbled upon on the TV early in the day, and it shocked me that they would attribute the kind of fraud that used to take place in the welfare system to disabled people today who are fighting all these other barriers. And I waited till the newscast was rerun later in the day and wrote all the advertisers, and the campaign at CTV stopped. But yeah. It seemed that somebody had seized on something they'd imagined as
yeah.
a potential attention getter.
This periodically comes up, including welfare fraud.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, every so often in the media you read about a case of welfare fraud. You read about waste in the welfare system.
Right.
And, of course, welfare fraud is dwarfed by non-payment of taxes by the rich.
I had no idea.
Oh, there's very clear evidence of that. Again, lack of appropriate reporting, and even if you look at cases in the news
mm-hmm.
For income tax evasion and so on, the amounts that a welfare recipient is dealing with are generally quite small.
Yeah.
The amounts that a very rich person is dealing with are generally very large.
Yeah, yeah.
So we don't see a balanced approach in the media.
Okay.
The media is very ready to demonize the poor, sometimes in subtle ways. I don't think we see anything very direct anymore.
What's subtle?
Well, you know, just by emphasizing the case.
By covering it.
Yeah, by mentioning someone's address, that it's in the inner city.
Okay.
By saying the person had visited a welfare office.
Okay.
I mean, I see these in the paper all the time when they don't seem to be relevant to the crime.
So,
by focusing not on the fact that panhandlers are on the street barely staying alive, but trying to find the few middle-class kids who are out panhandling and focusing, overemphasizing the dangerousness of panhandlers and so on.
Yeah. Yeah, and tarring all panhandlers with that middle class mm-hmm. brush, as if they might not need to be out there on $590 a month in Ontario.
But of course, there are also examples on the other side. For example, the Toronto Star has had several very good series that I think do point out the real privation that the poor live under in a very reasonable kind of way.
Oh, okay, all right. Who was the author of those? Do you know?
Carol, I'm blocking on her last name.
Okay.
But there was actually a poverty series with quite a few articles.
Okay. Yeah. We scan the Toronto Star and the Globe for news about people with disadvantages and disabilities, but I see so much of it that I'm blocked on it too. I can't recall anything that far back. But interesting to hear about. Is Ontario the center of this kind of investigation?
Well, I think the Star has been important. I think at various times media in other parts of Canada have also looked. CBC Manitoba has looked and so on.
Okay, good. All right, so the solution you think lies in the organization such as the one you're involved in?
Part of the solution.
Okay. And the missing parts? Education, you mentioned?
Well, yeah, I think a number of things. I think it's absolutely essential to try and make poverty enough of a political issue that people are voting for parties that are committed to poverty reduction.
Right.
And there has to be a kind of harder edge to looking at policies that favor inequality.
Yeah, that's true. That never gets any attention
from the Harper government.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it has to do with finding ways to, again, to use a strange metaphor, to invite the strange bedfellows in, to convince business that poverty has a cost, that lowering poverty will have benefits for the economy, including for business, quite apart from the moral arguments. The Senate Committee on Poverty, I think, and Senator Siegel, a conservative senator, have gone a long way towards making that argument. We think we need to find more of our friends in the corporate community, who are ready to put that argument forward. I think we have to engage healthcare professionals, especially doctors who are high status. It's one thing for them to agree that poverty is a key determinant of health. It's another thing for them to start to take a strong stance saying, look, money has to be spent on reducing poverty if you hope to have a healthy population and maintain the healthcare system.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of it has to do with engaging others in this.
Yeah. With attention to crossing income and status lines.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
It's a matter of convincing people of the truth that poverty is an issue for everyone.
Yeah.
That the non-poor are harmed by the existence of poverty in their community in a whole lot of ways.
Yeah, yeah, I can hear that. Was there anything else that you wanted to add to what you've told us about this situation?
Well, I mean, the other thing I would say is I think it's important to challenge what's in the media.
Okay.
If it is arguing that we don't need a poverty reduction strategy in this country, and that's partially what Margaret Wente's article was arguing.
Right.
The poor are doing fine,
yeah,
and I think
recall.
People who can should be writing letters to the editor. That's what motivated me to write the letter to the editor,
yeah.
To say, look, this can't go unchallenged. People can't think that this is okay and the poor are doing so well.
Well, I thought your point of view was very relevant, that from a third world perspective, people in Canada who are poor may be doing a little better.
Right.
But that these other stigmas still attach,
exactly.
mentioned, the discrimination, the ill health. This is true in the third world. This is true in the developed world.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's not relative, like the dollar factor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your point of view, and I hope, that you've brought some new understanding to anyone
Great.
Who's listening.
Great. Enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you for your time.
Okay. Take care.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
That's all there is for Disrespect this week. Due to a technical oddity in the system, I have put this show together without hearing any of it. Any misperceptions or miscues are mine alone, and I apologize for the technical difficulties that we've been dealing with. While you've been listening to the show, I've been in the admitting room of a major regional hospital. I'm going in for a small coronary procedure, and I hope to be back on the show next week. well wishes are appreciated, but there really is no need. The odds of coming out of this, the other end of this, in good shape are very high. Thanks again, and we'll see you next week.